Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Will Falk. He's a biophilic writer and lawyer. The natural world speaks, and Will's work is how he listens. He believes the intensifying destruction of the natural world is the most pressing issue confronting us today. His first book is How Dams Fail, Stories the Colorado River Told Me. You can follow Will's work at willfalk.org. So first, thank you for your work in the world, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you very much for having me, Derek. I'm really excited to be here.
So tell me about your book, and tell me about the Colorado River.
Yeah, so like you just said, the book is called How Dams Fall, subtitled on representing the Colorado River in the first ever American lawsuit seeking rights for a major ecosystem. And the idea for the book started in the summer of 2017 when five of us who live in the Colorado River Basin helped to file the first ever federal lawsuit seeking rights of nature for a major ecosystem, the Colorado River. And we made some interesting decisions in filing that lawsuit. One of the first decisions we made was to list the Colorado River as the plaintiff and caption the case so that it was the Colorado River and not the five of us who was actually suing the state of Colorado and the Colorado Attorney General. So in a sense, the Colorado River was my client, and whenever a client comes to me seeking legal advice, the first thing I do is I ask the client to come into my office, and I ask her who she is and what she needs and why she would need my services. So I figured that I needed to do the same thing with the Colorado River. So the original idea with the book was to ask the Colorado River who she is, and then go to her and ask her what she needs, and to do this, the Colorado River runs from northern Colorado all the way down into Mexico, so I wanted to ask her these questions in as many points or on as many points along the river as I could. I think that, people might say, isn't that weird? Can a river speak? And I actually take the notion very seriously that non-humans and the natural world, and especially ancient and powerful beings like the Colorado River, really are speaking, and they really have things to teach us, and they really have lessons for us to learn, and they really want to speak with us if we can take the time and if we can learn how to sit with them and listen. And so the book represents the things that the Colorado River told me, the things that I heard, the things that I learned while traveling with the river. The lawsuit was dismissed before I was able to bring my writing into the courtroom. I had planned on using my experiences and the writing I did and using it as testimony on behalf of the river. I knew that if the lawsuit progressed far enough, there would be a point where we would be able to present evidence. And I knew that it was unlikely that the judge would go listen to the Colorado River. And it was also impossible to bring the Colorado River into the tiny confines of a courtroom. So I wanted to do my best to take the river's testimony and present it to the court. Well, that never happened. So I wanted to publish the book as a way to make sure that the Colorado River's testimony was heard. And so that's what the book is and what it's about.
So who is the Colorado River?
Wow. The Colorado River is a tremendously complex and diverse being, a tremendously powerful ancient being. I wrote in the book that I could I would need more than my own lifetime to sit with the river and really listen to her and really be able to understand even a small part of her story. So But I think it is immediately apparent if you go to the Colorado River and if you sit on her banks, to see how powerful she is. She provides water for close to 40 million people in the United States alone. She provides a habitat to countless non-human species. She provides habitat especially to freshwater aquatic species that are some of the most, if not the most, hardest hit species by civilization today. There was a famous report by the Living Planet Index, I think in 2014, that found that the world has lost 60% of its wildlife since 1970. But freshwater aquatic species we've lost 82% of those since 1970. So the Colorado River provides a home to very vulnerable species. She has spent millions of years carving a path from the Rocky Mountains in Colorado through Red Rock deserts in southern Colorado, through Utah, through Arizona. She pushes all the way through very arid parts of Arizona and California and Baja California to ultimately deliver her waters into the Pacific Ocean, where she completes her part of the water cycle. And this is a place that the places that she flows through are places that are not friendly to water, as I like to say. And what I mean is they're just very dry places. And there's a lot of things that try and stop the Colorado River from getting to the ocean. And she is a very resolute being that for millions of years has braved those elements to fulfill her role in the water cycle and ultimately in the Earth's life support system. She's a very necessary being for the planet. And because of that, it just makes the things that humans have done to her in the last 200 years even that much more heinous.
So a couple logistical questions. One of them is, do you know, like what rank perhaps, the Colorado River was in the United States or in the world in terms of large rivers? And also, by volume prior to damming. And also, do you know how long it took for water to get from, spring to ocean before it was dammed, before the river was dammed? Rough ideas even.
Yeah, I don't, I'm not sure how, like where she ranks in terms of length or, volume compared to other rivers. I know that, she routinely, appears in, notorious lists of the most endangered rivers in the world. She's a fixture on those lists, and which is, I guess, really interesting because the Colorado River really has a reputation in the American cultural consciousness, I guess, as being this really wild, really rugged river. It was the river that John Wesley Powell, famously braved in his little wooden boats in the 1870s. But the Colorado River is not that wild and rugged being that we think of, that a lot of Americans imagine her to be. She's a very, I call domesticated river. There are massive dams on her. She is massively overdrawn. She is particularly affected by climate change, by how climate change is affecting snow patterns in the American West. And she is affected by agriculture in the Rocky Mountain West. She's used something as a toilet for agricultural runoff in the region. But I do know in terms of specific numbers about volume, she's usually somewhere between 13 million acre feet and 14.5 million acre feet. And the reason that this is important is all of American, all of the body of Western water law dealing with the Colorado River. There's a really famous law called the Colorado River Compact, which seven American states are party to, that was drafted and enacted in the 1920s. And that Colorado River Compact took the base total volume of the Colorado River as 15 million acre feet. And this was at a time, it was a really wet period for about a decade in the 19 teens and early 1920s. And they think that 15 million acre feet is about, the greatest capacity that the Colorado River has ever had. The Colorado River has not seen 15 million acre feet in decades. So they use this number, 15 million acre feet, to divvy up the water between seven American states. They kicked Mexico a little bit of a bone, and Mexico gets some of the Colorado River's water. And there are several native tribes and nations that have rights to the Colorado River. But like I said, the Colorado River hasn't seen 15 million acre feet in years. And the laws on the book assume that she is 15 million acre feet, and then proportion the water based on that. So in other words, American law proportions Colorado River water that simply isn't there. And that's why, or one of the major reasons why, the Colorado River doesn't flow to the ocean anymore. And it's also a good example of sort of the insanity of American water law, and how you can't even begin to protect a being when you can't even characterize her in the right way. That's kind of the extent to what I know about the volume. I'm not sure how that compares to other rivers. I'm not exactly sure how long she is. I know that most years she dries up somewhere in Baja California. Some years she gets so dry that she doesn't even make it to Mexico. She dries up in the California desert. So, you know, when you're thinking about a river, a river is supposed to flow to the ocean, is supposed to flow into other rivers, is supposed to link up with other bodies of water, and the Colorado River doesn't. And that's one thing that I bring up in the book is, you know, if a river is supposed to flow to the ocean and the Colorado River doesn't flow to the ocean, is it even fair to consider her a river anymore? I visited one of the Fish and Wildlife Service's fisheries in Grand Junction, Colorado, and I went out to write this book with a photographer named Michelle McCarran, a really great photographer. But Michelle and I rode with this director of the fishery there in Grand Junction, and he was describing how they can manipulate the Colorado River's temperature by letting some water over one dam and out of one reservoir, and letting that water into another reservoir. And he said that the Colorado River is basically a huge bathtub, and you know, human control of the Colorado River has gotten to the point where they can control her so thoroughly that they can change her body temperature. That really, I think, contradicts this romanticized picture of the Colorado River that the American consciousness, the American cultural consciousness really clings to.
A couple things. One of them is that, it seems that the Colorado River has 15 dams, and The next thing is, you were talking about water allocation, and that reminds me of the Colorado River is one of the first places where I really understood the insanity of Western water law. And my understanding is that even in wet years, more than 100%, like 115% of the water in the Colorado River is allocated to agriculture, industry, etc. And in fact, they're building more water pipelines and more pumps to take more water out, and removing more than 100%, or allocating more than 100% of a river's water seems to me one of the best examples in the world of this culture's complete insanity.
Absolutely. You know, my first reaction to that, what you're saying is true. Something like 78% of all of the Colorado River's water goes to industry and agriculture alone, and especially corporate industry and agriculture. So oftentimes, when I talk about the Colorado River, or, you know, when I was writing the book, people would ask, you know, they would say something like, you know, I live in the Colorado River Basin and I water my lawn. I feel like I'm a hypocrite. I can't advocate for the Colorado River when I have to use her water. And, you know, the fact remains that only about 10% of the Colorado River's water actually goes to household uses in the Western United States. So this means that even if everybody just disappeared from the Colorado River Basin, if all 40 million people just disappeared, the Colorado River would still be overdrawn by agriculture and industry and corporations. We're really talking about institutional allocations of the Colorado River. We're talking about you know, capitalism being a major problem, Western water law being a major problem, and while obviously we all need to do our best to conserve water, the truth of the matter is individual humans are not as much to blame as industry, agriculture, corporations, etc. You know, American water law, I think the roots of insanity, the insanity that is American water law, can best be summed up in just realizing that American law treats the Colorado River as property. Western water law makes it so that people who, you know, the classic way of explaining it is Western water law is use it or lose it. So, Western water is allocated to those who make the most, quote unquote, beneficial use of the Colorado River. And what they mean by that is not allowing the river to flow down the river where it can benefit the countless natural communities who depend on her, but beneficial use is defined as watering crops, as being used in gold mining operations, as you know, even being used for things like invasive fish species, which in the 50s and 60s, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services went on a campaign to destroy native fish populations so that they could introduce more traditional sport fish like walleye into the Colorado River. But all of this stems from the fact that American law defines the Colorado River as property. And whenever you define a living being as property, you objectify that living being. And as we know, property is something that people can consume, use, destroy as they see fit. And when you get more water based off how you exploit it, American law incentivizes the destruction of the Colorado River.
One of the things that I really loved about your book was the manifest love you have for the Colorado River. And can you share a couple of help listeners of this interview to fall in love with Colorado by sharing a couple of your favorite places or beings from the river? And these can be ones that you actually interacted with on this trip or ones you just know about.
Yeah. I think my favorite place with the Colorado River is where the Colorado River flows through Canyonlands National Park in southern Utah, a little bit south of Moab, Utah. Canyonlands is also the place where the Green River converges with the Colorado River. They call it the confluence for short, the confluence of the Green and the Colorado. And the reason that this is my favorite place to experience the Colorado River or to be with her is that, you know, Canyonlands is still a relatively untouched part of the Utah desert. You know, I say relatively, there's lots of threats to, Canyonlands, you know, everything from, climate change is going to hurt the desert too, to, you know, current public lands policies threatening the size of Canyonlands. But the reason that Canyonlands is my favorite place to experience the Colorado River is you're relatively removed from civilization. You're relatively removed from all the very many injuries that the Colorado River is suffering. And so you can experience the Colorado River and Canyonlands much like humans have always experienced the Colorado River. And it's possible, perhaps for just a little while to forget, the suffering that the Colorado River experiences, to, forget about the dams, to forget about the pollution, to forget about, the overallocation of the Colorado River's water, and just to experience her as humans for time immemorial have. You know, that's my favorite place. That's the most, I guess, comfortable place to witness the Colorado River. But if I'm going to say that, then I need to explain too that there are so many places where you can go, especially if you're saying, like, what are you talking about? I've seen pictures of the Colorado River flowing through the Grand Canyon, through Moab National Park. The Colorado River is this, you know, wild, amazing, you know, natural being. She's still, she's still, I don't know what you're talking about, all this harm that's happened to her. I would advise people to like I did, start at the headwaters of the Colorado River, which is on the north side of Rocky Mountain National Park, and go and try and find the Colorado River. The first thing is you probably won't be able to find her because there's a huge reservoir at the north end of Rocky Mountain National Park called the Long Draw Reservoir. And there's a sign that says you are in the headwaters of the Colorado River, but there's no water around anywhere. There's an irrigation ditch that that tries to collect snow runoff, and it shoots it across the Continental Divide over into Long Draw Reservoir, which, you know, it's then pumped all over to the Front Range of Colorado, over to Denver and Fort Collins and Colorado Springs. But, you know, if you really want to get to know the Colorado River and really get to see what I'm talking about, start there and go and see if you can actually see something that resembles a river. You won't be able to. And that really begs the question, you know, or it really opened my eyes to see from the very beginning of the Colorado River's life, from when snow falls out of the sky, collects on the Rocky Mountains, and then starts to melt. That's where the Colorado River is born in at least, I guess, somewhat arbitrarily, I have decided that's where the Colorado River is born, because in reality, the Colorado River is part of a much bigger water cycle. But if we say that that's where she's born, then we'll realize that almost from the very beginning, or not even almost, she is stillborn. Her waters are stolen from the moment that the snow that would become the Colorado River hits the ground. And this destruction happens all the way down her length. The major dams are obvious things. Another place that I went to, and it really became clear to me what's happening to the Colorado River, is Grand Valley, Colorado, which is the valley that Grand Junction, Colorado sits in. There you can see where there's all kinds of crazy stuff in Grand Valley, Colorado, like peach farms in the middle of the high desert, wineries. I really blew my mind. There are all kinds of vineyards in Grand Valley. And all of those things, peaches, which, you know, are not necessary to life in Colorado, wine, which is definitely not necessary to life anywhere. All of that is possible because people are stealing water from the Colorado River. I guess those are just two places that really helped me understand the problems that the Colorado River is facing.
So I'm gonna ask a question, and I'm also going to tell you how I want you to answer it.
That's great.
The question is, how do dams harm rivers? And you can answer however you want, but part of what I would like your answer to be has to do with the effects of the removal of spring floods. Do you see what I'm asking?
Yeah, I think so.
What I'm getting at is the project that they've done in the Grand Canyon with releasing water to simulate floods. But so talk about the problems of floods in general. I'm sorry, the problems of dams in general, and then including increasing water temperature, et cetera. And then from there, at least mention also the effects of flooding, because that's a huge, huge effect on not just that river, but every river.
Yeah.
Obviously, another effect of dams is they inundate the area behind the dam, which kills it. But right. Anyway, so I'll shut up now and let you answer the question.
I guess the way to start that is by saying floods are a natural and necessary function of a river. It's rivers flood areas. That's part of what they do. It's also there are all sorts of life forms that have evolved to thrive in areas where rivers flood. Humans, at least industrial, modern, civilized humans are not some of those people, or at least they think that they can't live in a flood area. And so one of the primary justifications for damming a river is to control floods, since they threaten humans. This is a disaster for, like I was explaining, those freshwater species that have been hit so hard. One of the reasons that we've lost 82% of freshwater species since 1970 is the proliferation of using dams to control these flood areas. The fact that the Colorado River dries up before reaching the Gulf of California, one of the major problems with that is there are all kinds of species, all kinds of non-humans that lived in that area where the Colorado River used to flow through. Now the Colorado River doesn't. Their habitat has been destroyed by dams and by overallocation, that kind of thing. So, you know, it's a classic example of human supremacy to justify, controlling, floods with dams. You know, and human supremacy is the idea that, non-humans exist, human life is superior to all other life, and non-humans, we shouldn't consider non-human concerns when we consider human concerns, or even worse, non-humans only exist, for human use. And when you believe something like that, then, you think of rivers and floods as a nuisance or as a danger, to human life. And because humans are supreme to everyone else, we must control that flooding so that, we can't, it doesn't hurt humans. You know, another thing that, dams do, I guess, that, maybe that another thing that dams do is they subdivide the river, and when the life forms in fish, for example, in the rivers, you know, they don't consider when they build dams, where are these fishes traditional mating and spawning grounds? Where do fish have to get to on the river? Some fish, you know, cruise for hundreds of miles up and down the river. And so one thing I learned a lot about are how some of the endemic Colorado River fish species, things like Colorado pike minnow and razorback suckers, a really rare endemic fish that only exists in the Colorado River, have had a horribly hard time reproducing because they can't get to their traditional spawning beds because there's a huge concrete wall in front of them.
Go ahead.
That's another reason why dams are bad. There's there's a lot of reasons why dams are bad.
So I actually don't know much about the aquatic fauna of the Colorado. You know, if you talk about the Columbia or the Klamath, we think of salmon, sturgeon, lamprey. You know, there's all sorts of fish we can associate with various rivers, but I actually honestly don't know the fish of the Colorado. Can you help us fall in love with a couple species of fish in the Colorado? Who lived in the Colorado 200 years ago?
I think that there, I can't remember the exact number. I think there is, something like 15, endemic fish species, in the Colorado River. Right now there are four that are really on the edge of extinction. They're the Colorado pike minnow, which, was previously known as the squawfish. But the Colorado pike minnow, is one of my very favorite fish in the world because, it is the world's largest minnow species, again, endemic to the Colorado River. And this is a minnow that can be, 6 or 7 feet long. These are massive fish that live, at the bottom of the riverbanks, and are just, you know, I think one of the coolest things is just to think that you could be swimming in the Colorado River and 5 or 7 feet below you, there's a 6-foot pike minnow, the largest minnow species in the world. Another one is razorback suckers. And I think one of the interesting things about razorback suckers are some of the functions that they provide for the rest of the Colorado River community. The endemic fish species that are threatened in the Colorado River are primarily the bottom feeders, the ones that are you know, essentially eating the excrement of other fish, and by doing so they keep the Colorado River clean. And this is an absolutely vital function within this community. And you know, what was the life of a fish like 200 years ago versus now? Well, one of the differences is the Colorado River's water was much cleaner, was much more free of fish shit, essentially. If we look at the water today, because species like razorback suckers are struggling so much and aren't able to perform their natural role in the community, the Colorado River's water is much dirtier than it otherwise would be. And that's something that I fantasize about. If you go to the Colorado River now, there are places where the Colorado River flows pretty clear and the river's water looks much like it always has. But for the most part, the Colorado River isn't very clear. You're going to see brown and green and orange and yellow water. A lot of that has to do with agricultural runoff, but a lot of that has to do with just the proliferation of shit in the water that these other fish would have been cleaning up. One of the most powerful original joys, one of the greatest things for a human to experience on the banks of a river, is just to see, clean, healthy water flowing through riverbanks, to see clean, healthy, pure water, flowing over stones, flowing under, trees, flowing under the shadows that trees make, being able to spy, a fat cutthroat trout, in the shade and sun that dapples over the Colorado River's water. To me, this is just one of the most original and ancient joys that a human being can experience. And, that experience, we've destroyed that experience by destroying, fish like razorback suckers. There's another endemic fish species, the bony-tailed chub, also a bottom feeder. The bony-tailed chub is one of the most endangered fish anywhere. I might need to check this, but I'm not sure that the bony-tailed chub can reproduce without human help. But the bony-tailed chub is known for its it has this really thin part of its tail before the back of its tail opens up really wide, and it's a really beautiful fish, an ancient fish, and an extremely rare fish, but another one that human activities have really harmed. The more you study the history of fish within the Colorado River, the more you'll encounter some truly terrifying scenes. There are plenty of accounts, and proud accounts by Fish and Wildlife Services of government employees, the way that they cleared out endemic fish species in the 50s and 60s was quite simply by sending electric shock currents into the river, which almost instantaneously kills fish, just shocking them to death. So they would stick this electric pulse into the water, shock the river water, and all these endemic species would float to the surface. These government employees would gather those dead fish, and then they would stock walleye and northern pike and other invasive species in the water, so that sports fishermen could fish for walleye. Interestingly, one of my very favorite fish in the whole world is walleye. I grew up fishing for them in northern Wisconsin, but walleye do not belong in the Colorado River. And walleye are really, really good at hunting endemic fish species. There's no real native predator for walleye. Even though walleye aren't a very big fish, they wreak havoc on younger endemic fish. They eat really young juvenile fish really quickly, and you know, we're having a hell of a time trying to alleviate the pressure that walleye are putting on other fish in the river. And it's totally a problem that we created in the last 50 years.
And in the history of stupid ideas that is this culture, that's one of the stupidest.
Yes, I totally agree.
So we have about 10 minutes left, and one of the things I would like for you to do is, and I completely agree with you, but I want you to defend this position. You keep talking about the river as a living being, and I mean, I can see you in court, and I can see the opposing attorney going, no nervous system, no brain. Obviously, you are delusional. This is not a person.
Right. And
I completely agree with you that rivers, I mean, I think clouds are alive. I think that mountains are alive. But in any and between the two of us, let's try to defend this position.
Yeah. So my first response to that is the Colorado River is so much more than a person. What person could facilitate the lives of 40 million humans and countless non-humans? So that's the first thing. The second thing is quite literally. The judge who lived in Denver, we brought the case in the Denver courthouse. Denver gets a lot of its water from the Colorado River. There's a strong likelihood that most everybody in that courtroom, if they were speaking, if they were hydrated in courtroom, if their lips weren't cracked and bleeding and they weren't desiccated from lack of water, they have the Colorado River to thank for that. The Colorado River is a part of them. Once you take a drink of the water is a part of you. And of course that water is going to flow through you. And, you know, if we didn't interrupt all the cycles that water go through, that water would return to the Colorado River. So in many ways, all of our bodies are on loan from the Colorado River. Our health is a direct effect of the Colorado River's, existence. So first my first answer would be you're right. Colorado River is not a person. It's so much, she's so much greater than a person. Then my second answer would be, how sure are you that you're not part of the Colorado River? How sure are you that you're not, your personhood depends on what the Colorado River brings to you. So I guess those would be my two strongest answers.
Those are great.
Thank you.
So what do you see? We have 6 or 7 minutes left now. What do you see as, I would like for you to lay out for me some worst case, most likely case, and best realistic case, and fantasy wonderful case for the Colorado River over the next 100 years. And start from worst to best.
Yeah. Well, the worst case is that human population in the Colorado River Basin continues to increase, and along with that human population increasing, there's more agriculture, there's more industry, there's more golf courses in the Colorado River Basin, there's more peaches and watermelon and other crops that simply should not be here. There's more vineyards in the Colorado River Basin, and
cotton, for crying out loud.
Cotton, yeah. Arizona.
Alfalfa, for crying out loud.
Soy, you know.
Citrus orchards.
Just stuff that, as human population increases, those crops are more than likely to increase. And when those operations, when those businesses multiply, the demand on the river is going to multiply. The other thing is, climate change, is making less and less, snowfall in the Colorado River Basin. Climate change is, or snowfall is a major, one of the major ways the Colorado River regenerates. She does rely on some freshwater springs, but snowfall is a bigger, regeneration. Those freshwater springs, as more people and more businesses come to the area, those freshwater springs are going to start to get targeted as, you know, we're seeing the privatization of water around the world, and springs are never safe, right now. So those springs are going to be targeted too. So, you know, worst case scenario, the Colorado River in 100 years, you know, I don't know how to say, like, what will the Colorado River look like if she's only, you know, 10 million acre feet. She's going to be a lot. She was not going to run as long. She's not going to be as strong in the places that she needs to be. She's not going to be able to deliver, her life-giving waters to everyone that needs them. So that's kind of, I guess that's the worst case scenario. The best case scenario, and I guess what's more important to me to talk about, is how do we get to the best case scenario? And to me, the best case scenario, is the Colorado River, is running into the Gulf of California, with the same amount of at pre-industrial levels. So, you know, before Europeans got to the Colorado River, I want to see that amount of water, falling from the sky, flowing through the Colorado River, delivered into the ocean. It's going to take this culture collapsing for that to happen. There some of the obvious targets, to benefit the Colorado River. And, you know, I wrote the book and I called it How Dams Fall. In some ways, you know, I don't want people to think that that's a metaphoric thing. What I'm trying to show in the book is what the Colorado River needs are physical things. She needs the dams to fall. She needs climate change to stop. And, you know, there's all kinds of ways to make a dam fall. We could go into court and, we could win a case and the judge could order a dam to be removed, and we could use government employees to do that. I'm here to tell you as a lawyer that is, almost absolutely not going to happen. But there are other ways for dams fall. You know, the explosives come to mind, and, you know, I would argue that, the sooner that these dams fall, the better. And we need to stop waiting around for the government to do the right thing, for, lawyers and judges to do the right thing. And we just need to do the right thing for ourselves and free the Colorado River.
So if this is a question I ask myself, we have a couple minutes left. And this question I ask myself all the time about different species, that, you know, if Delta smelt could take on human manifestation, how long would the pumps on the Sacramento River last? If coho salmon could take on human manifestation, what could they do? So if the, I believe it was, pike minnow? What was the name of it? I'm so bad with names.
Yeah, Colorado pike minnow.
If those three fish and jaguars and peccaries and other beings who rely on the river in one place or another, if they could take on human manifestation, what would they do?
The first thing that they would do is target the dams. They would take the dams out. You know, the second thing that they would do is they would target, global, energy production. They would target those processes that, are most directly contributing to climate change. Because all of those beings, need more snowpack. They need more water. That's what they need. And climate change is a major reason that water is not falling. The water is not there to regenerate the Colorado River. And climate change, we know, is produced by physical things, by industrial processes, electricity generation, fossil fuel combustion, all of that. I think that they would go and shut down those the industrial infrastructure that produced climate change. And I think that would give them a really good chance to heal the Colorado River.
And I guess you probably have answered this 10 times now, but I never explicitly asked you, when you were listening to the Colorado River and you were asking the Colorado River what it needs, what was it saying to you?
She said all these things too. The first thing, I think the first thing that you hear, and maybe this is a little obvious, but you hear water running. And water, but what is the sound of water running? The reason that you can hear it is friction. You can hear water moving over stones. You can hear water moving over land. You can hear water, stirring with tree leaves. That same sound, that same motion is the same sound that produces the sound of the Colorado River slapping the faces of dams, the Colorado River trying to get to the Gulf of California. So the first thing I heard, the first thing anyone will hear when they hear the Colorado River moving, you'll hear her desire to deliver her waters where they're needed no matter what. And that's what I heard. And, in order to do that, she needs physical help. She needs the things that are stopping her from delivering her water, to be eliminated.
Well, thank you so much for all that. And thank you for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Will Falk. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.